It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The federal government's flagship climate report comes out every 4 years. It explains how global warming is affecting our country, and it could go extinct under the Trump administration.
Here in Wisconsin and across the nation, local governments use the National Climate Assessment to help guide their environmental policies.
Earlier this month, the Trump administration said it would be cutting contracts with ICF International, which oversees most of the staff supporting the National Climate Assessments program.
We'll get to perspectives on the climate research cuts and how it may impact environmental policy in Wisconsin going forward. Tony Wilken-Gebhardt is Executive Director of Midwest Environmental Advocates. That's a nonprofit law center based in Madison. Tony, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Hi, Kate. Thanks so much for having me.
And Dan Vimont is here, professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison and director of the Nelson Institute Center for Climatic Research. Dan, welcome.
Hi. Good to be here.
Dan, let's start with you. You previously served on the Science Review Committee for the Climate Science Special Report, which the National Climate Assessment is based on. Can you give us a sense of how major this climate report is and how it's prepared?
This is a big effort, and it's used across the United States. So the National Climate Assessment is an assessment of the current state of climate in the United States, and so it's a objective assessment by hundreds of scientists around the U.S. And so coordination of that effort is a big deal. And that's important to have that coordination so that the process is transparent, so that a review process is put in place, and so that we're providing an objective and vetted product that future decisions will ultimately be based on.
So hundreds of scientists across the U.S. contributing to the report. I would imagine logistics and timing certainly on the research has to be very coordinated.
It's a big effort, yeah, and it's not something that someone can just pick up and do. And that's why I think there's a contract, or why originally it was contracted out for running those logistics.
Tony, how do state and local governments put this national climate assessment to use for shaping policy?
Well, the data and the research that's included in the assessment definitely drives decisions that we use here in Wisconsin to prepare for climate change. And I think that's important to emphasize. The kind of cuts that we're talking about is not about a disagreement in, you know, how much to invest in renewable energy or whether we should be reducing greenhouse gas emissions. These cuts go to the heart of preparedness and planning. So for instance, and this is something Dan's research has helped shape. We know that our region is at greater risk for flooding. We're seeing more intense rainfalls in Wisconsin and the Midwest. And so the data and the research that's included in this assessment is used by federal, state, and local governments to manage that risk, to inform how we are making infrastructure investments that can withstand the kinds of risks that we'll see into the future. And so when we lose this kind of climate intelligence, it is invariably going to lead to worse outcomes and missed opportunities to protect Wisconsin communities.
If communities lose this type of climate intelligence, as you call it, where would they turn to? What type of data and statistics would they use?
Well, I think that's a really good question. I think folks across the country are trying to ask themselves, what will be the impacts of this wholesale disinvestment in climate preparedness and intelligence? This is not the only cut that we're talking about. We've already seen the administration slash funding and staffing at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. That's the lead federal agency that tracks the systems that support life on our planet. And just in the last couple of days, side by side with this announcement to slash the climate assessment, the administration's budget proposes to slash essentially all funding for NOAA's climate and weather research. So Hopefully these cuts will not be permanent. Hopefully we can push back, engage Congress in this effort. It's worth stating that the assessment is mandated by Congress by a law that was signed in 1990 by President George Herbert Walker Bush. And so Congress has a role to play here. If the federal government continues to cut funding, I don't know to what extent state and local governments can make up what we're losing.
Dan Vimont, Congress requiring a new assessment be issued by 2027. You know, your thoughts there, is that possible at this point? What would need to happen to stay on track with that directive?
That's a good question. I mean, I don't think this is the sort of thing that can happen just sort of organically. There does need to be coordination of this. I think there will continue to be efforts at assessing climate. You know, we're certainly doing that here in Wisconsin with the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts. But the importance of the NCA is that it is a congressionally mandated effort, and therefore it has more of a legally binding, or there's more footing there for making decisions. And the problem is that communities, smaller communities around Wisconsin, around the U.S. as a whole, just can't afford to do this sort of stuff on their own. And so the NCA is an opportunity to provide this kind of information, just data, just plain data, providing information. I love that phrase, climate intelligence, for communities that can't necessarily afford to do this on their own.
That is Dan Vimont, Nelson Institute Center for Climatic Research Director. Tony Wilkin-Gabart is here, head of Midwest Environmental Advocates. That's a nonprofit law center, as we talk about the impact of cuts to the National Climate Assessment Research Program. Tony, President Trump has called climate change a hoax, and that's despite the scientific consensus that our fossil fuel burning is the primary cause of global warming. Do you think is denial behind this action?
Yeah, I think that's definitely part of it. Just even listening to the news lead in, we're seeing so many cuts to scientific research and study. Governments try to put forward policies that are unpopular and put communities at risk, it makes sense that they would try to cut also our ability to understand what is happening and to respond. So I think this is a really disturbing trend that we're seeing play out across government, across sectors, and it's important that we respond to the threats. And like I said, in this example, we're talking about something that is mandated by Congress that has traditionally had bipartisan support and that is used in red counties and blue counties in Wisconsin to keep communities safe, to inform the kinds of decisions that farmers are making. The chaos that the Trump administration is creating by these kinds of cuts, this kind of denial, could have a real direct impact on chaos that we'll see in our everyday lives moving forward if we lose our ability to respond and to prepare for the kinds of impacts that we are surely going to see.
Dan, you're in the thick of climate research. How does the National Climate Assessment situation compare to other science-related freezes and reductions by the Trump administration?
I don't know that I want to compare those. I would say as a whole, it's very disconcerting to see that kind of every aspect of our society is being weaponized for political purposes at this time. And climate change seems to be just one example of that. This is not a political issue. It's, thermometers don't care who's in the office, mm-hmm. And by undercutting our ability to monitor and assess the current state of our world, we are we're disadvantaging ourselves economically, and we're disadvantaging ourselves in national security as well. This is something that we should all you know, recognize that just monitoring our world is important for our economy, for our national security.
And how could cuts in environmental research impact the government's ability to respond to climate challenges in Wisconsin and elsewhere?
I think just this effort at you know, sticking our heads in the sand. For example, right now the only part of our energy economy that's growing exponentially is renewables. And we're outsourcing that essentially to other countries and allowing that market to go elsewhere, where we have, you know, a strong history of manufacturing here in Wisconsin. There are opportunities here that we are throwing away by ignoring the reality of our current world.
Tony, is there litigation ahead, do you see, or any way in the courts to fight this?
Well, that remains to be seen. I wouldn't be surprised if there is litigation, considering this is a congressional mandate. But we've seen a pattern here where the Trump administration, rather than trying to have the law changed, just cancels a contract that is funding the work that needs to be done to comply with the law. Most presidents, I would say almost all presidents, understand that they have an obligation to uphold the law. This administration doesn't care about that. And so this has been a weak spot. How can the courts compel the government to follow through on its obligations, especially when this tactic of just canceling contracts is the way that has been used to undermine federal law? So we will have to see. I wouldn't be surprised, but there are some challenges ahead in that regard.
Tony, thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me.
And Dan, thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, I wish I weren't. Mm-hmm. The circumstances, but thanks.
Yes. Dan Vimont, professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison, director of the Nelson Institute Center for Climatic Research. Tony Wilkin-Gabbart is executive director of Midwest Environmental Advocates. We've been talking about the repercussions of staff cuts to the federal program that drafts the National Climate Assessment.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, a state task force focused on missing and murdered Indigenous women is set to release its finding. Among the things their group will call for is to
more expeditiously, you know, search for and locate our relatives when they go missing and bring our relatives home, and to ultimately deliver justice for those who have been murdered.
Insights from that task force next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. 37-year-old Melissa Beeson has been missing from the Lac des Flambeaux Reservation in northern Wisconsin for 30 days.
Since then, the Lac des Flambeaux Tribal Police Department and search and rescue volunteers have conducted ground, air, and water searches.
Beeson is a member of the Lac des Flambeaux Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians. The Bureau of Indian Affairs estimates that there are 4,200 murdered and missing person cases that have gone unsolved.
In the recent State of the Tribes address, St. Croix Chippewa Indians of Wisconsin Chairman Thomas Fowler called this a public health crisis and honored a victim.
In January, a San Carlos Apache teenager, Emily Pike, went missing. Her remains were found nearly a month later.
Wisconsin's Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Task Force is preparing its recommendations on how to prevent homicide, trafficking, and violence against Indigenous women.
Brooke Johnson is the task force's coordinator at the Wisconsin Department of Justice. She's a member of the Stockbridge Muncie Band of Mohicans Tribe. And Justine Rufus is chair of this task force. She's a member of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. Welcome to you both.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us. I'm so happy to be here today.
Justine, let's start with you. Can you take us to this moment? What is the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Task Force working on now?
So our task force was created back in 2021, so we've been working on the task force since then. We have a very large task force with over 40 members. We created four subcommittees, a data committee, a family impact committee, a systems committee, and a legal committee that's been working on creating recommendations for a report that we'll be submitting. And we do have a deadline of the end of this year to be issuing that report for the state of Wisconsin. Our report is really unique because we're not only going to create a report on the status of MMIW in the state of Wisconsin, but we're also going to be the first state to have an implementation plan where we will have more actionable items that we'd like to see taken forward.
Brooke, how do you feel about that implementation plan that lays out, okay, here are the steps to get going on this issue?
Yeah, definitely. Our implementation plan is really an accompanying implementation plan that will go along with the final report, and it recommends actions that can prevent further loss of Indigenous culture and life, and pretty much practical steps that we can all take to improve safety for Indigenous women and relatives. It addresses barriers that contribute to trafficking of Indigenous relatives, and more expeditiously, you know, search for and locate our relatives when they go missing and bring our relatives home, and to ultimately deliver justice for those who have been murdered.
Hmm. Brooke, are there any aspects of these recommendations and implementation steps that you see glimmers of, that you see in progress now, or objectives that the state has some movement on?
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of things happening simultaneously that we didn't even expect to be in progress. Like one of our recommendations had been, it stemmed from being able to ping locations off of cell phones. And that was such an issue before. We weren't able to ping locations and get a solid location without going through multiple jurisdictions. And that has been something that was a huge issue when we were trying to, you know, find somebody immediately. And they had just passed last year, I think it's statute 968.373, which really is about a warrant to track communications devices. And now they have made it a lot easier to ping locations in emergency situations.
Hmm. Justine, nearly 5 years of this work, what has surprised you?
I think I say this every time. The most surprising thing was when we gathered together to create this report. We didn't really realize how many families were going to reach out to us because, unfortunately, they don't have a place to go when their relatives go missing. So we as a task force, our job was tasked to create a report in the state of Wisconsin on the status of murdered and missing Indigenous relatives. We never anticipated that families that had relatives that went missing or families that were desperate in having old cases, getting them reopened or folks to investigate them would come to the task force and ask for our help. We're a place that they do recognize that they can reach out to us, and we do, one, believe them. Two, we will try to use our networks and our communities. We have task force members from all of the tribes, and we've even worked with folks to go into the streets and look for relatives with some of our nonprofits that are doing this work. So I think it's the connections that make them reach out to us.
Brooke, can you step back and provide some context and explanation as to why Indigenous people experience higher rates of violence and higher rates of murder, abduction, and trafficking?
I mean, it's alarming when you look at it, but, you know, intersectional issues has a lot to do with it. The intersection of gender-based violence and MMIWR is heavily intertwined. And these disappearances or murders are often connected to domestic violence, you know, and dating violence and sexual assault, stalking, sex trafficking. You know, these things are all connected. And so when we do education to the public, to the youth, or to whoever, we also try to educate on those intersectional issues. Because then it helps shine a light onto why, you know, why we are where we are today.
Do you think this report and these implementation steps will also provide some of that missing education that people don't have about this issue in Wisconsin?
Oh, definitely. This will definitely provide education, and not only the implementation plan, but the final report as well. The final report will have a lot of like the structural forces and the types of discrimination, the aspects of identity, and why we have become a target for MMIWR and MMIP as well, because our men are missing at a high rate as well. And we don't want to leave any of our Indigenous people out when it comes to, you know, the abduction and the murders of Indigenous people worldwide.
Justine, I want to focus a bit here more on data. The National Crime Information Center had reported that back in 2016, there were over 5,700 reports of missing American Indian and Alaska Native women and girls. So that's nearly a decade ago. But at the same time, the Department of Justice's Federal Missing Persons Database only logged a little over 100 cases. Why do we see such a disparity in those numbers?
I think the reality is most of our relatives live off reservation, so not in our tribal jurisdictions. I think that's one of the issues. So we just don't have the data. We don't have jurisdictions outside of our reservation that are really interested in classifying our people and where we're from. So I think that that's really been a challenge. Also, I think as we've done this report and talked about those issues about recording here in Wisconsin, I think we still fail to create the systems in place in the future to record our murders properly. And so I think if there's a lack of data, then we see a lack of resource and funding that support this crisis. And so I think that's one of our frustrations, is knowing that we are not getting the information of how many of us, because it is a crisis. And per capita, it's extremely alarming, the amount of our relatives that are being murdered and missing. Folks ask me, is it really happening here in Wisconsin? And the answer is absolutely. And so I know in my lifetime in Bad River, I'm from the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. I know in just my lifetime that in a very small community where less than 1,000 of us reside, four women have gone missing from my reservation, and that's just the women. The men are even higher than that. And so we know that in these small communities, tribe after tribe, those numbers are astounding compared to other small rural communities.
Mm. We're talking with two people involved in the Wisconsin Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Task Force. Justine Rufus is chair of this task force and the rural coordinator of the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Brooke Johnson is here, the task force's coordinator at the State Department of Justice, as we learn about this work of the task force and its forthcoming report. Brooke, do tribal police departments face any unique challenges in searching for missing persons from their reservations?
Yes, every jurisdiction, as I've learned in this position, faces unique, limitations when it comes to jurisdictional complexities. And tribal governments have inherent sovereign authority over their lands and their members. And that creates, due to limitations imposed by federal laws, like the Major Crimes Act, tribes often have restricted jurisdiction when it comes to prosecuting certain crimes committed by non-Indigenous individuals on tribal lands. And this jurisdictional gap can create challenges in prosecuting traffickers, kidnappers, or anyone that does commit crimes against our Indigenous people who are not part of the tribe. And as the further we get into this work, even Justine will tell you, we've worked with a lot of people from a lot of different, walks of life throughout the entire state who have been able to help with the collaboration piece and the coordination piece. And that's something that is really lacking, not only in the state of Wisconsin, but, throughout the world, is collaboration and coordination when it comes to jurisdiction and being able to eliminate some of the profound negative effects that they have on tribal communities.
Hmm. We recently talked with Lacta Flambeau Chief of Police T.J. Bill, whose department has been working very hard to search for 37-year-old Melissa Bisson, who's been missing since March, and other missing persons in their community. And let's take a listen to what he had to say.
unfortunately, we've had three other missing person cases in the last 4 years. So we've had like one a year. And Newbold Search and Rescue has dropped everything and come to our aid to help us. And in those three past missing persons, it's unfortunate, you know, they perished, but Newbold found them for us, brought them home, and brought closure back to the family. So we don't have a lack of resources up here. Even though we're northern Wisconsin and we're in the middle of nowhere, it's the resources we have is invaluable.
Justine, the chief of police there, explaining the resources and what you hear from that, it seems like this relationship is working there. What do you hear?
I've talked to DJ Bill, and it does sound like at this point he has some supports in his community. And so we're happy to hear that he does have some assistance. We also talked about, as this case goes further on, hoping that those resources are still available, you know, or long lasting, because it's expensive. It costs small communities like Lactofamil, who has a very small police force, a lot of funding as this continues to go on for the search. I think as I go community to community, it really is about trying to build those partnerships, or because Wisconsin's a public law 280 state. So we do rely on our county partners to prosecute these cases. And so it's important to create good relationships, but that's not always the case. And we know that that can have profound impacts when you're looking for a relative if you don't have the resources to support you, because we are such small communities.
Brooke, I want to turn to you. As you hear about the situation with Melissa Bisson and the search, what can people do who are hearing this? What can they do to help authorities, whether it's this case or any case of missing and murdered Indigenous women?
You know, advocacy and preventative measures are so important. I mean, the more that you educate yourself on the topic and you're able to really understand, you know, the unique vulnerabilities that a lot of Indigenous communities face today, there's everything from community empowerment and education to youth engagement and mentorship, you know, legal reforms and advocacy, awareness campaigns, collaborative partnerships, just like we heard TJ Bill talking about how he has the resources there. That was never the case. You know, you wouldn't have been able to find a tribe in the state that really had, you know, sufficient resources or that collaboration to be able to say, hey, we have everything we need. So even just like on the ground searches, you can volunteer and you can get trained on how to do ground searches. We have many awesome nonprofit organizations in the state of Wisconsin. I mean, in honestly, really education. That's one thing that I really, really try to advocate for is education and public awareness campaigns. So that way, you know, the general public is able to educate about the risks of not only trafficking of Indigenous people, but just trafficking in general. Looking at the rate of, you know, the risks and the intersectional issues that Indigenous people go through and be able to advocate for them properly.
Justine, can you talk about the funding you currently have in Governor Evers' budget and how that's being used?
Yes, I think it's really important that everyone knows that now when we're often asked, how can you act? How can you get involved? And I think now is the time for action. Currently, the Finance Committee is having current listening sessions throughout the state about the governor's budget. And the last cycle we included money for MMIWR office to support our relatives in this work in Wisconsin. And this year we have a request for a budget item for tribal liaisons for families and relatives. As we move past this task force, there will be relatives that are looking for folks to support them when their relatives are murdered and going missing. And so we have asked for a budget for liaison positions. We've also asked for increased funding for our law enforcement. And so we really do applaud the governor for including this crisis in his budget. And so we're encouraging folks to call your legislators and also the Joint Finance Committee to encourage them to approve the funding for the MMIWIP
And Brooke, what would you like to see out of this report when it's published?
My hope would be that we don't have to have task forces like the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women's Task Force. My hope would be that my daughters don't have to deal with the issues that we're dealing with today. They don't have to be afraid that they will become a statistic. I'm really hoping that we can get some positive change that impacts generations.
Justine, how about you?
I am really hopeful for the future that there's some action that's taken, more resources, more funding, laws that are changed in the future that really create those impacts that Brooke was talking about. We have a long road ahead of us because there hasn't been a lot of actionable steps. I think one of the things that we're most looking forward to in our report is that we lay that out with the implementation plan. We're giving you the exact recommendations into an action plan. Mm-hmm. And I too hope for the future that we aren't going to have to continue to see the loss in our communities the way that we currently do in the future.
Justine and Brooke, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Justine Rufus is chair of Wisconsin's Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Task Force. Brooke Johnson is the task force's coordinator at the Wisconsin Department of Justice. We talked about the work of the task force to address the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women and its forthcoming report. Melissa Beeson of Lac des Flambeaux is still missing. Anyone with information is encouraged to call the Lac des Flambeaux Tribal Police Department at 715-588-7717 or the Vilas County Sheriff's Office at 715-479-4441.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, visit a Waukesha group that supports survivors of human trafficking in the region.
I think it's important for the state to ensure that there are enough resources for trafficking survivors.
That's coming up next here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. April marks National Sexual Assault Awareness and Prevention Month, and an organization in Waukesha County is looking to raise awareness of what they say is an underreported problem, human trafficking.
Southeastern Wisconsin has the most reports of human trafficking. Waukesha County has the second most reports in the state after Milwaukee County.
Numbers vary from year to year, but it can be hard to get a handle on long-term trends because of difficulties in detecting and reporting the crime.
The Women's Center in Waukesha County serves thousands of survivors each year who are impacted by domestic abuse, sexual violence, child abuse, and trafficking.
Angela Mancuso is director of the Women's Center in Waukesha County. Angela, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start by talking about your organization a little bit. The Women's Center of Waukesha dates back to 1977. Can you talk about the mission, the need that the founders were looking to provide?
Sure. So we work with adult and child survivors of domestic violence, child abuse, sexual assault, and human trafficking. And we're working with all populations who are exposed to those crimes. We've been around since 1977 strictly because of demand, of course. And the programs that we offer, we do have an emergency shelter that's for people who need that immediate safe place to stay. We have transitional living units that's for individuals who are a little further removed from their trauma, but need that, it's exactly what it sounds like, transition period to get back on their feet. We have a 24-hour hotline. We do a lot of group work and individual work, trauma work, psychoeducational work, support groups, workshops. Legal advocacy is a large component. We're providing a lot of restraining order support for Waukesha County and court accompaniments with survivors. We are the Child Advocacy Center for Waukesha County as well. and we're doing rape crisis response for the county. So we're responding to 10 hospitals as well as Carroll University. And then we're doing prevention work, child abuse prevention work. We have an employment program. We also do have, specifically for our topic today, we have two of our program directors who are specifically certified, trauma certified, in working with individuals who have been exploited through sex trafficking.
And turning to trafficking, what would you describe as the frequency? How big a problem is this in Waukesha County?
You know, this is a grossly underreported crime, so that's always a loaded question.
Sure.
I would say for the Women's Center, on any given year, about 20% of our client population identify as trafficking survivors. But it is a, you know, it's a huge scope of problem. The 2023 DOJ site, I believe, has Waukesha County as the second largest reported, that's a key phrase, reported sex trafficking crimes.
This is a key part of the story. Why is it difficult to put numbers on this, to make sure that we have as many of these cases as happen get reported?
Because it's very complex. Mm-hmm. I mean, all of the crimes, sexual assault, trafficking, child abuse, domestic violence, are very complicated and very nuanced situations. And while individuals, significant population of individuals might be exposed or experiencing this, they're not always identifying themselves as that way. And that, you know, really speaks to the manipulation and power and control that's exercised over trafficking survivors in the moment. But, you know, it's not often that we have someone call our hotline and say, hi, I've been trafficked. What do you have? You know, what services do you have for me? It doesn't look like that.
Every case of human trafficking is going to be different. But can you paint us a picture of what that often looks like, that manipulation you're talking about that ends up with somebody trapped in this situation and not feeling comfortable reporting it, not having a notion that they could report it?
You know, a lot of trafficking survivors aren't sure that, you know, they may not even be aware that they have rights. You know, there might be statutes or laws and services, you know, places like the Women's Center that are specifically there to support them. But, you know, we're talking about vulnerable populations who are often targeted for trafficking, which is another key component of why this crime is so slippery, I guess, for lack of a better term. Traffickers, you know, they're very savvy individuals. And I think that's, you know, one myth particularly is we like to envision traffickers as, you know, what goes on in a Liam Neeson movie. These are savvy individuals. They are tracking trends. They're on the internet. They read the news. They stay on top of what's going on to better control their victims and survivors. They target and they groom and they work on gaining trust from their victim. They will meet their needs. Then we're going into isolation and exploitation and maintaining control. And the tactics that they use are, you know, profound and can really keep someone trapped in that situation.
You mentioned people who are particularly vulnerable. Who is at the greatest risk of being exploited in this way?
Children in the child welfare system or juvenile justice systems, runaway and homeless youth or adults, unaccompanied children, migrant workers, of course, that's pertaining more to labor trafficking, persons with limited English proficiency, disabilities, individuals with prior history of abuse or sexual violence, persons experiencing generational trauma. Often the trafficker is someone that is known to the victim or the victim's family.
You mentioned in one way this is not like we might picture from movies we might have seen. What are some of the most common misconceptions that you run into that people might have, that I probably have for that matter?
That traffickers target victims they don't know, when really the reality is that they often start off in a relationship or as a boyfriend, romantic partner, or as a close friend of the family. Traffickers, I mean, I've heard of situations where they will groom somebody for years. I mean, years that they can trick and fool and manipulate someone psychologically. Some traffickers are definitely in it for the long haul. So it's not always a stranger. It's not always a, you know, an immediate kidnapping from the street. Those situations, of course, do happen. another myth is that, you know, only women and girls can be victims of and survivors of sex trafficking. And again, that's not the reality. We certainly have worked with young men who are survivors of trafficking. Another myth is that trafficking is always or usually a violent crime. And I guess that speaks to what I was just saying about, you know, the kidnapping or physically forcing someone into a situation. A lot of traffickers, like I said, use psychological means, defrauding, manipulating, threatening victims into providing commercial sex or, you know, further exploitation.
Angela Mancuso is with us, executive director of the Women's Center in Waukesha. We're talking about the issues surrounding human trafficking, the challenges of reporting cases and help available. Angela, it seems like one big challenge is you've got these services, but how do you reach the people who need them the most? How does the message get there to find people who are being trafficked?
Sure. I mean, and that's really through to really take on and address and support survivors of trafficking. It's a community. It requires community involvement. So, I could speak to Waukesha County. We have very strong partners who work with the Women's Center. There's a group called FCAST, the Faith Coalition Against Sex Trafficking. They do remarkable work and also a lot of work in Madison for state law, you know, Redeem and Restore and other organizations that are working with vulnerable populations. Because for any nonprofit, any organization, anybody can actually encounter a victim or survivor of trafficking. So it's really getting together and working together, whether that's a multidisciplinary team with law enforcement and, you know, people, individuals from the criminal justice system, faith community, direct service, or if it's, you know, doing prevention work, providing a lot of trainings, getting in front of groups of people, getting in front of students. That's one of the things that we do at the Women's Center. We're in a lot of schools in Waukesha talking about identifying traffickers and internet safety and things like that. But it requires a team. And we rely on law enforcement to help and participate. We rely on our DA's office and our judges to also make sure that traffickers and abusers are held accountable and that survivors are provided referrals to resources that will support them. And of course, there is a lot of word of mouth as well that can happen between survivors and between the partners that I just identified.
You mentioned that often, in many cases, people who are victims of trafficking are groomed by someone they know, an acquaintance, friend of family, what have you. Are there things that bystanders, third parties can watch out for, signs that someone they know is at risk of falling into this, of being a victim of trafficking?
You know, there's tattoos and branding that traffickers will use, and it could be, you know, learning what those look like. I would say individuals that are constantly being monitored, don't have control over their money, they have no ID, few or little personal items, minors under the influence of drugs, alcohol, or in the company of adults, or much older men, for example, much older individuals, signs of physical abuse, fear, malnourishment. Some individuals, you know, if you ask, you know, where they are, they wouldn't even be able to tell you what city or state they're in because of how they're moved and transported. Really, individuals of any age who appear to be watching or approaching youth systematically, you know, trying to befriend strangers, you know, it's a high statistic of runaway youth who are, I think it's within the first 48 hours. They have a high risk of being approached by a trafficker.
Now, when someone is connected with the Women's Center in Waukesha, what are some of the first steps that you do to work with a victim to see to their physical and emotional well-being?
I mean, first it's, helping them get comfortable. It can be terrifying to get away from your trafficker. And I mean, one of the first things we have to do is identify location services on any devices. And if there's any indication that they're tracking their victim through, I don't know, pieces of jewelry or, tags on a car, we need to identify that for their safety. And then it's letting them sometimes decompress. And I will say, we try to make it as comfortable as possible and give them space. it's overwhelming. But then, you know, we're sitting down and really talking through what they are identifying as their needs are. It is not our place to tell them what they need. We are helping them identify what their needs are. And then we're going from there. Is it legal counsel? Is it housing? Is it getting connected? They may not be from the state of Wisconsin. They might have been trafficked all over and landed in Wisconsin and then found their way to the Women's Center. Could be getting them home, finding a trusted friend or family member that we could get them to. And of course, supporting any mental health needs. And a lot of times, traffickers are really good at ensuring their victims have criminal activity. It's a means of keeping them there, right? So it might be solicitation, tickets, could be drug charges, something like that. So we would definitely connect to legal resources to help them with that. It's really whatever they need. And it's a long journey. It's not just a, oh, this is great. I'm saved and no problem. It is a long journey. And for the Women's Center, we're there at any step of their journey. They can come and go as they need with us.
You just reminded me of something I wanted to ask about when it comes to the difficulty of reporting and detecting crimes. A victim of sex trafficking might think, well, I've been sex trafficked. I've done something technically illegal. If I report my trafficker, am I also going to be charged with a crime? Do you see police departments, prosecutors, the court system taking that into consideration, saying, okay, if we're charging the victims, we're not going to get the real criminals here?
Yes, and is how I would answer that. I mean, we do have a very good team, you know, in Waukesha County, for example. So again, it's very nuanced, and I would say it depends on the circumstances. And a lot of times, like I said earlier, someone who's been trafficked, they're not necessarily identifying themselves that way. They might come to us under a domestic violence situation or a sexual assault situation, but not linking that to actually being trafficked or exploited. We have to work with individuals within the, I guess, the parameters of the crime that they're coming to us with. And then when trafficking comes out, we definitely work with our systems partners and law enforcement, specifically those who have gone through extensive trafficking training, really can do a good job in helping a survivor feel more comfortable and feel safe that, look, this isn't actually about you at this point. It's about you getting safe and free, but we want that trafficker.
In 2023, Wisconsin created a task force on human trafficking. Looking ahead, what is the biggest resource that you think could come from the state level that would help your work in Waukesha and similar work around the state?
I bet you could predict this answer. I would say funding and resources for that, because it's, like I said, legal counsel going through the criminal justice system, healthcare needs. You know, there could be a lot of medical injuries, a lot of needs with mental health, and that all requires resources. I mean, some trafficking survivors, you know, don't have any, they've never had credit, so a credit card, they don't have health insurance, they, you know, they're not sure how to acquire any of those benefits. So I think it's important for the state to ensure that there are enough resources available 24/7 for trafficking survivors.
Angela, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Angela Mancuso is executive director of the Women's Center in Waukesha. If you're a victim of human trafficking or believe someone needs help, you can call the National Human Trafficking Hotline. The number is 1-888-373-7888. That's 1-888-373-7888. Last week, we shared the work of Karen Wynn Fonstad, the late Oshkosh cartographer who created the Atlas of Middle-earth and many other legendary maps of fantasy worlds.
And we heard from a lot of you about it on Facebook. Crystal says, I own both the Atlas of Middle-earth and the Atlas of Pern. I've spent many hours poring over her well-drawn maps.
Neil said, wow, Karen Wynn Fonstad's work was a huge inspiration for me when I was a kid. I had no idea she was in Wisconsin all that time.
Valette says, I loved her work. I brought so many of my favorite books threats to life.
And Instagram user Mr. Paphos tells us, the Atlas lives on my bedside table. It's a beautiful, wonderful work that is beloved by many. Thank you for this profile of Karen Wynn Fonstad.
And thanks for all the comments. Keep them coming to us. You can email Wisconsin Today at WPR.org, or you can call or text to reach us at 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Royce Padeswa, Beatrice Lawrence, and Courtney Everett. Our technical directors are Sarah Hopeful and Tyler Ditter. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.